Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 16, delivered on October 20, 2016. The title of this lecture is Stock.
Tonight, stocks. Now, I've already talked about almost all of this with you before tonight. But this is sort of like a consolidation of the concept of stocks. And I'm going to make it kind of timely here, and I'm also going to give you a little bit of investment advice. Not what to buy, but how to be an astute investor so that you will eat more than cat food in your old age. I know, right? I'm excited. Huh? Well, of course they do. And I mean, my cats eat better than I do. I mean, fancy feasts every night. If I don't feed them fancy feasts, then they do unfortunate things. Hey, where the hell was I? Okay. I talked to a group a couple of nights ago on investing. They wanted me to give a general talk on how to be a good investor and how to make smart investments. And I was pointing out to them that you are going to need an awful lot of money when you retire, because most of you are going to live to be 100, possibly more than that. And if you do, you're going to need a lot of money when you retire at the age of 70 to 72 in order to ride out the rest of your life with a comfortable income. To give you how grim it could be, you take a situation like mine, where I believed in the system, I had my Social Security, and I had a pension that was being collected from the state, money was being collected from the state. At this point, if I can live to be about 72 years old, I can retire on $1,500 a month for the rest of my miserable life. I know, let the good times roll. And that's how bad it could be for you if you don't pay attention to investments and invest for yourself. Because one of the things that is coming, and I've said this before, the next huge crisis in American politics, economics, is going to be the collapse of the pension funds. Many corporate pension funds, state pension funds, what have you, are going to go into crisis in about 10 years. About 10. It'll just suddenly be in the news, there's a big problem out there. Oh, who would have ever imagined that there could be a big problem like this? And there's going to be a lot of political upheaval, social upheaval. At the same time this is happening, you're going to see the main flux of the age of the machines come in. 3D printing will wipe out 10 million factory jobs, well-paid, good-paying factory jobs. About 5 years later, artificial intelligence will wipe out most of the accounting jobs, finance jobs, management jobs. The artificial intelligence isn't here yet. They say AI, it's fake AI right now. But it'll become real, and then you, with your degree, will be out of a job. Unless you can be really, really flexible and be able to find a way to survive in that system. That means that what investments you need to do, you need to start doing very soon so that you can ride this very difficult wave out through the end of this century and into the next century. And you will live into the 22nd century. You won't. But that's just because of that wild lifestyle of yours. So here's the thing. Listen carefully as I talk. First of all, stocks. Stocks come in two major flavors, equity as we call it. There's preferred stock and there's common stock. Preferred stock is that, is there some reason I don't have a marker? I don't have a marker. Okay? So I'm going to just have to wing this because the marker thief has been back around here since this morning. Because my marker that was here this morning is now not here tonight. Anyway, I'll just have to wing it. Huh? Is this a real one? Do you remember? Were you in? Was that the class?
No, I'm a tutor, so I carry a marker.
Oh, okay. Well, no, the morning class, someone gave me a marker one day, and I started marking one, and then I realized it's not a dry erase marker. I hid from the building maintenance people for a week. No, I'll just tell him he did it. No, that's what it is. Okay, there's preferred stock and common stock. Now, really? Really? Preferred stock and common stock. Okay, preferred stock. The thing with preferred stock comes before common stock. The dividend on preferred stock is a fixed amount. The dividend is stated as, on the certificate itself, it's stated. And it's stated as a percent of the par value of the stock. So you could have ACJ preferred, 1.5% preferred, par value $50 a share. So what that means is that 1.5% of $50 will come to you as a check every year. It is what we call a fixed income security. They used to be very popular, fixed income securities, like preferred stock, because old people could invest, throw their life savings into these. They were preferred stock was quite safe. It didn't whipsaw up and down capital gains wise very much at all, but it still had that nice flavor of investing in equity. But you got a certain amount, a fixed amount of money every year for the rest of your life. Something just occurred to me. I could just use the overhead here. Right. Power. Document. Yeah. There we go. Okay. Yeah, this will work. It'll be fine for tonight. Okay. So we got preferred. You know what? That's just going to make me hurl. I know it. Okay. Preferred. Okay, so now on preferred, you would have like ACJ, 1.5% cumulative preferred, par value. Oh, let's take it as $60 per share, okay? Now, there are a couple of things here. This is means that your dividend, your fixed dividend, is going to be 1.5% of $60. So in other words, that would be 60 cents and 30 cents. That would be 90 cents per share would be your dividend. And you would get it every year forever. So in other words, if you owned 1,000 shares of this, you get a $900 a year check from them. Now, the sum preferred is cumulative. Cumulative here means, and I know I've already mentioned this, but cumulative simply means that the stock will pay the dividend, and no common dividend can be paid unless this preferred has got its dividend. So if the company doesn't have money to pay the preferred dividend, it doesn't have money to pay the common dividend, a common dividend. And cumulative means that if it doesn't pay the preferred dividend, those dividends accumulate. so it backs up. So they'd have to get all of those back dividends paid to the preferred before they could go forward and pay the common shareholders a dividend. That's what makes this preferred stock is a cumulative preferred is quite relatively is safe. It's almost as safe as a bond in a lot of situations. Not as safe, but it actually behaves quite a bit like a bond. It pays a coupon like a bond does, but the big difference is that the face value isn't 1,000, it's whatever the stock certificate says it is. And it is forever. A bond pays only for a fixed amount of time, like 30 years. But you can see why this is popular as a fixed income security. Somewhere along the line, and I honestly don't know when this happened, after my days in consulting were over, I walked away. I just washed my hands of it. I thought, screw this. I was teaching English. I was teaching economics. I was teaching anything but finance. I wanted to get out of the world of it. When I came back into the world of a teaching here some years back, things had changed. One thing that had changed, there were so many, but one thing that I found out had changed was preferred was no longer popular with fund managers, with wealth management. They didn't use preferred stock as part of a portfolio for, let's say, an old couple, two old people who are in their retirement years. Oh, we'll invest in a lot of things, but we don't invest in preferred stock anymore. Why not? Well, we just don't. Oh. And if you look out there, preferred stock isn't as usual as it used to be. However, interestingly enough, preferred stock is still out there spinning around, and some companies still use preferred stock as a preferred way of raising money. I was just a while back, I was looking through, is there some kind of company that tends to be more likely to issue preferred stock to raise funds? Yes. Real estate investment trusts are very big in preferred stock. Real estate companies in general seem to like to issue preferred stock instead of common stock. They prefer to issue preferred stock instead of borrowing money on bonds and notes, interestingly enough. So it seems like it's still alive out there, but the companies that are raising their money by selling preferred stock, it seems to be a lot of real estate companies now and not other companies. Now let me give you a couple of warnings. Preferred stock does not flop around. It doesn't jump around in price very much. It's very stable. You're not in preferred stock to make capital gains. You're in it for the dividend. You're in it for the fixed income security component. And I'll show you why that is here in a minute. It's actually kind of obvious once you see the math of it. But anyway, be careful with preferred stock. I've seen, once I started investigating again, I got back into the world of securities and I started looking at preferred stock. There are all kinds of oddball things in preferred stock that's being issued now. One I saw was preferred stock that has a call provision. The company can, at its discretion, after a certain number of years after issuance, the company that issued it can call it in and exchange it for common stock. So you would have bought, let's say, 10,000 shares of preferred stock of ACJ. You think, okay, I'm going to get my nice dividend forever and ever. And then the company, it turns out, has a provision in there that, let's say, after 10 years, they can turn it into common stock on you. And then all of a sudden, you're in the world of common stock where there's no requirement that they pay you a dividend at all. And so they've pulled the rug out from under you. That increases the risk of the preferred stock considerably. And I don't know. I would probably be very skeptical of that kind of a trick in preferred stock, unless I was getting a great bargain on it. Let me show you something here. Look, I showed you this formula a while back, the formula for a perpetuity. The constant growth the no growth perpetuity. the present value of an eternal cash flow stream is nothing but the cash flow per period divided by the market's discount rate on that cash flow. That is the formula for an eternal amount of money coming to you forever and ever and ever. Now, in terms of preferred stock, the way we write that is the price of a share of preferred stock is going to be the dividend divided by the market's discount rate on those dividends. So in other words, if the market is discounting ACJ preferred dividends at 1.4%, then all we'd have to do is the price of ACJ preferred is going to be the dividend, 90 cents per share over 0.014. Now, let me get a calculator up here real quick. And I'll just simply take the 90 cent per share dividend divided by 0.014. And I find out that the price per share is going to be $64.29. Do you see how it's not moving very far from par? As discount rates move up and down with macroeconomic forces, with the risks within the company itself, whatever you want to talk about, the price of preferred stock will go up and down, but it's going to pivot on that par value of the stock. Unlike common stocks that could go anywhere, you could buy a share of common stock for $10 and it could be $1,000 someday. Preferred stock is not going to do that. Preferred stock is going to have that essentially that peer sitting in the solid ground, and the stock price may go up and down around it, but it can't go too far from it. So in other words, you're not buying preferred stock as a speculative instrument at all. You're buying it as for the dividend it pays. This brings us to common stock. Common stock. Now, I've talked about some of this before, and I'm going to talk about it again here. There are a couple of flavors of common stock. One thing you want to make sure of is that you own a share of common stock, that gives you one vote for each of the board of directors who will represent you. The board of directors are the ones who hire and fire the executive management. They make the big, big decisions of the company. You, as an owner of a share of common stock, have one vote for each of the directors on the board of directors. However, if there is more than one class of preferred, a class A and a class B, that would probably mean that there is a group of insiders, probably the original founding family. They have a kind of stock that you don't have, and that common stock has super voting power. So the class A might have 10, 100 votes for every one of the Class B shares that you could own. You'll never be able to have the Class A shares. And so, in other words, you'll never be able to really decide who the management is or who the board of directors is. It'll always be controlled by the insiders who own that inside stock that you can't get to. So understand that. And even if you don't have a situation like that, even if you have just one class of common stock, which is relatively typical, your vote is going to be so small compared to the total number of shares outstanding. And your vote is going to be small compared to the power of the controlling interests. Now, however, you can go to the shareholders meeting. You can vote. You decide you're going to go big time. You bought 10 shares of Apple. By God, you can go to the Apple meeting. You know, you can sit around there and talk with the big dogs. You're an owner. You have the right to. At some of these meetings, you might even be able to have a say in the meeting. You know, I need my minute. Please give me Robert's Rules of Order to say I can speak. We don't do that as much now as we used to, and there are a couple of reasons. One of the big reasons is it started back in the 1990s. In my time, you would have these groups buy a block of common stock so that they could go to the meetings and make trouble. Or go to the meeting. Well, I shouldn't say make trouble. So let me give you an example. You would have an environmental group buy 100 shares of the common stock of a company, and then they'd go to the annual shareholders meeting and they'd raise hell. They say, you are not a company that is respecting the earth. You're not green. You are behind the technological curve on what you're doing. You're still using dirty technologies that are going to be waste, and you're not getting ready for the 21st century. They went to the meetings and they raised holy hell. Another one that was well known in the 1990s, Wendy's International had a group that was anti-smoking that bought a block of like 1,000 shares out of hundreds of millions. They went to the meetings and they raised hell saying, Wendy's, we want you to make all your restaurants non-smoking. There wasn't anything about smoking, non-smoking back in that time, but they wanted Wendy's to make all their restaurants non-smoking. So they had the shares, they had the right to go to the meeting and raise holy hell. Now, of course, they didn't have any power to vote their interest in, but they certainly did make life miserable at some of those meetings. Anymore, the shareholder meetings are more controlled so that you don't have people able to do quite as much of that trouble, at least at the big sophisticated meetings. But you can still go and vote your shares. So you've got your 100 shares of a company. Well, okay, now I am the insiders. Now, what I really want is to keep my job as a director. And I want to keep my way of running the company with these executives. So I'm going to say, here is a card. Please fill it out and give me your votes by proxy. Please sign this proxy. Let me have and allowing me to vote your share. And then what I'll do is I'll vote, obviously, for my slate of directors, my dogs. And then I will keep my people in the company. But this son of a dog right here is actually working wahaha for another group that wants to put in another group of directors. Now, what these guys have done is they've already taken position in the company. They've probably had to disclose if they go above a certain percentage of stock, but they've already bought a position in the company. So what they're going to do is they're going to try to leverage that by saying, hey, would you sign ours, our proxy, and we will vote out this son of a bitch, me, and that means that when we get in, we will fire these people, we'll keep you, you turncoat bastard, you. And so you get to be part of a proxy war, okay? And you have to decide. I'm going to tell you, well, look all I've done for you. And they're going to say, sir, you have done nothing. The stock price sucks. You suck. Yeah, go ahead.
What exactly is the shifting in the directors become a hostile takeover?
Say it again. Explain. When it becomes known and I don't like it, I say, I don't want these people in my company, I don't. And if they keep pushing it, it's hostile. They are black knights. Now, what's probably going to happen is that my next move is that I'm going to need to get a white knight. Someone who's going to start to take a position in shares of the company to buy and then to use his position to leverage with my proxies to be able to keep the executive management the way it is. The white knight will try to save my bacon. The problem is that it's going to get nasty because they're buying shares of stock to get position. Then he comes in and he starts buying shares of stock. So what's that going to do to the price of the stock of the company? Drives it up. But what's it going to do to the White Knight's company? It's going to bleed it, and his stock is going to go down. Because as the value goes up, if you keep pushing it, that means he's going to have to pay this insane price from his company's coffers. So that's going to hurt the White Knight's White Knight. So he's going to be not too excited about doing this unless it is a real sweet deal for him to do. Which means that he might be willing to help me by making my company look sucky. Is there a company right now that is an internet company that is very big that is being looked at by a very large telecommunications company? Yahoo! And who's looking at them? And what happened to Yahoo's stock price recently? Why? Well, spank me. How did that ever come out? So that was where the Black Knights came in and helped, and the White Knights and everyone helped push the price down to keep the bidding war from pushing the stock price up. So there's going to be all kinds of games, political games, economic games that are going to be played in this whole thing. Is there another company right now that is looks like it is quite vulnerable in the internet world? Twitter. Twitter is a company that no one really loves. Okay, are you on Twitter?
No.
I know you're not. Are you? You see, Twitter is a celebrities and artists and losers social media platform. I'm on there in a very big way. That's kind of sad. No, you know I am. You've seen me on there. And that's pretty lame, but that's exactly what the story is. So Twitter is vulnerable. The problem is that whoever wants it's got to figure out, is there something we can actually do with it to make it more than what it is? And that's where, who is there anyone interested in Twitter? Yes. And there's a couple others also. But what they're doing is they're more or less like pushing at it, just kicking it to see if it twitches before they go anywhere with it. But anyway, now, so you can have a proxy contest for a company. You've got Black Knights, White Knights, and you've got some in there that are just basically they're going to let everyone kill each other, and then they're going to step up the plate. My best bet would be to let you just drive the price up as a Black Knight, force you to the point where the price was just ridiculous. You acquire the company. You are so damaged that I can just walk in and take your company away from you, get that at a bargain price because I've wrecked your you've wrecked your own company doing that, and then I fire your ass for being so stupid that you let me do that to you. I could do that. Different tricks. That was one of my specialties back in the day. I was a mergers and acquisitions specialist, M&A. So, you know, there are all kinds of fun things. It's kind of fun to do that kind of stuff and know what's coming. Look for companies that are vulnerable, because a vulnerable company's stock price will go up during a bidding war. You shouldn't hold on too long, because that can get you into trouble sometimes, holding on too long in one of those proxy wars like that. But there you go. That's just how it works sometimes. Okay, so now, common stock. Large companies. Big, heavy-duty, industrial-strength companies. They are listed on the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE. Essentially, you want to buy 100 shares of stock. Now, let's say 10,000 shares of stock, okay? What you're going to do is you're going to call your broker. Now, the broker is going you're in the big city, Peoria. So you're going to call the broker, and you're going to say, I need 10,000 shares of Apple, okay? Now, the next thing that'll happen is that I, the broker in Peoria, am going to call the big dogs on Wall Street. Okay, New York Stock Exchange, you're a floor broker for my company. You're going to get the phone, ring, 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 I got it. Now, you can be a runner, run out to tell him to go buy, to do the buy, or you can use hand signals. That's the old thing. Hand signals were an art form and a science. You change your hand signals every hour or so just to make sure that the other people didn't, other brokers didn't figure out what your hand signals meant. But you'd say, let's say, 10, buy at price. And what that means is that you're going to buy at whatever the price is. Now, let's try it again without you being stupid. You're going to put a limit on the price. Right now, Apple, let's say, is at 116. You put a limit on the price of 120. Don't just say buy the stock, because the stock could go up through the sky and, okay, I'll buy it. Oh, it's 180. Well, he didn't say to stop. Yeah, so he buys it at you buy it at 180, and then they find him on the floor the next day with his hind leg twitching because he wasn't expected to pay $180 a share for the stock. You follow that? Moving along here, the next thing that we're going to talk about. So in other words, limit. Give a ceiling on the price. Limit. If you order stock, put a ceiling on it. But also, you might want to put a floor. Don't just say best. Now, if you say best, 120 or best, that would mean buy it at the lowest price you could get below 120. There might be a reason why you wouldn't want to do that. Wow, they got it for me at $105. Well, spank me, Muhammad. Oh, hey, don't. Okay, why? What's wrong with that? He done good for him. He got $105 for that Apple stock. Huh? What happened? Why isn't that maybe the best idea? He caught it when it was falling. That stuff could have been going down, 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 as Johnny Cash said, in the ring of fire, down to 80. So he got it at 105. It kept going down after that. So what he's got is he paid 105 for stock that was 80 by the end of the day, because Steve Jobs' ghost came back from the grave and he was really an ugly ass zombie. You understand what I'm saying? Is think about what you're ordering. Set your limits. Always set a higher limit, but don't always be foolish. Set a lower limit. Don't set it tight. But it might not hurt to say, you know, a lower limit on what you wanted to buy at, because otherwise you could have a tail going down and you could catch it on the way down, but it goes down a lot farther than that, okay? So just kind of keep those things in mind. Okay, now, I used a term here, broker. Now, this is legal business terminology I'm going to bring up to you. A broker represents the buyer. A broker represents the buyer. So that means that when you called me, I represent you now to get you the best deal I can, given your instructions. Okay? That's a broker. An agent is representing the seller. An agent represents the seller. That means if you go to an insurance agent, that agent doesn't represent you. It represents one or several insurance companies selling you products through the agency. Okay, keep that in mind. When you go to a real estate agent, the real estate agent is representing the seller of the house, not you. Go. They're still representing the company. And you should, I'm glad you brought that up. That's an excellent point. You ask, are you an agent or a broker? Now, real estate agents can act as brokers. If you go to a real estate agent and say, I'm going to buy a house. I want you to represent me in the purchase of a house. Then that agent could be a broker in that deal. But typically, if you call an agent, I saw this house. Hi, I saw this house that had your phone number on it as insurance agent. The agent represents the seller, not you. Now, there's one other term, the dealers. A dealer represents itself. A dealer represents itself. So a car dealership does not represent you, does not represent a car company. It is in the game for its own account. Now, I'm bringing that up because on the American Stock Exchange, the AMEX, every stock that is listed on the AMEX is being bought and sold by a dealer on the floor of the AMEX. The floor is nothing but a mass of dealers, each with an inventory of anywhere from a few dozen to a bunch, 100 stocks, that he or she is buying and selling for his or her own portfolio. And that's how AMEX stocks work. So if I go and I want to buy an AMEX stock and you are a dealer on the floor, you're the specialist. You're a specialist in that stock. You own an inventory of that stock. I have just gotten an order from you for $20 a share for, let's say, 50,000 shares. I'm going to go up to you. The trader is going to go up to your area, and I'm going to look up and I'm going to see you want 22, and I got 20 or best from him on 50,000 shares. I need 20. Do you have 20? No, 22. Go away. Get out of here. I need 20. Can you give me 20? No. And then you come up, you're trying to sell some of it, and you got 10,000. You're not him, but you're there too. Hey, did you need some stock? Yeah, what do you got? I got 10,000. Okay, that brings me to 40,000. 10,000 from you? Thank you very much. And then you come up, I got 4,000. Can you take that? I can take 4,000. Come on. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to bleed off your demand and pull your price down. Finally, you're going to start to sell it to me. I got 10,000 from you, 4,000 from you. That's 14,000 of my 50,000. So that gives me 36,000. You need 50,000? No, I need 36,000. You going to do it for me now? Yeah, 20. I got 20 from you. I got 1950 from you. I got 1975 from you. I put together my deal for 20 or best on the sale. That's a simple example. All in their heads. Everyone on a word is good basis. And then we clear the accounts later. But now I know you, I've got 10,000 from you at 1950, I got 4,000 from you at 1975, and you cleared my order for 36,000 at 20 on the button. Okay? That's how it would work. So when you got the bill for this, you would see kind of a composite price. For, in other words, you would see 10,000 times 19.50 plus 4,000 times 19.75 plus 36,000 times 20. And that's what your bill would be for. You might call me and say, how did this work? What did you pay for this? Well, it wasn't one price. I was dealing with the dealer, but I was also dealing with a couple of people who had some stock to sell. So that's how I put together your order. That's typical. That's normal. Floor trading is going away. In many markets, it's just gone forever. I took a bunch of finance students up to the Chicago Board of Trade about, I think, 3 years ago. And they were expecting to see that crazy pit with people selling and buying pork bellies and orange juice and interest rate swaps or whatever the heck, and bushels of corn or barrels of oil and all that. It was a ghost town. It was silent except for the options pit. The only reason the options pit is still active is because they do such weird-ass chains of options that even computers can't figure out what they're doing. But the open cry system is gone. All that was in there was silence, and in the stadium seating, there were some traders just hanging around watching YouTube videos of lolcats or playing World of Warcraft or watching porn. And that was all there was. It was dead. And they're just like, well, what's going on? And basically, CBOT is now run by a bunch of filthy rich kids whose families put them there so the kids wouldn't get into trouble doing something like dealing drugs out of South America. That's basically all that's going on there at CBOT now. Those stories and those pictures you've seen of the wild trading going away. Now, where this had actually long ago was with the NASDAQ, which was an entirely electronic system, was sort of the harbinger of what's around now. It was all electronic back then, and it still is now. I was a NASDAQ trader. I had a little penny stock house, and essentially everything is, there are market makers, little tiny stocks usually, and there are five or six market makers who have an inventory of the stock. If someone wants to buy some, we'll sell them some from our inventory. If someone wants to sell some, we might take it off their hands, but I mean, we'll tear them up on the price of it. Like, for example, you wanted to buy, you had some stock you bought in an offering of one of these little tiny companies. Well, you paid $4 a share for it. Now you want to get rid of it. First, you're going to have to find the market makers. Now you find me, my little company, and you call me, okay, I need to sell this stock. Well, what do you got? And I got, you'll give me the trading symbol. It would have four letters to it. And I'll look through, yep, I sure do have the inventory. I'm a market maker. Who knew? Okay, well, yeah, I'd like to sell that for maybe like $5, $6. Oh, no, I'm going to buy that from you for 50 cents. And you're going to call me all kinds of very bad names to begin with, mother. Okay? I paid $4 a share in the offer. Yeah, I know. So what? I don't have a dense market. There is not a market. You're the first person who has even mentioned that stock to me in 6 months. I'm going to buy it from you for 50 cents. And then you start wailing and crying and gnashing your teeth. Okay, fine, 55 cents. Take it or leave it. Well, next day you call me. Yeah, I'd like to buy some of that stock I heard about. It's, you know, it's probably a loser of a company, but you know, I'll just pick up a few cents. Okay, well, I got some for $5 a share. Yes, I'm going to hell, but so is Bill Clinton, and Bubba and I will have a condo together there. So screw it. Okay, that's how it works, okay, in the world of that. So if you see four letters, it's a NASDAQ stock. Three letters, it's probably an NYSC or a stock. Now, NASDAQ isn't just small companies. There are some huge companies that started on NASDAQ and they just stayed with it because they didn't want to go through the insane paperwork of getting listed on the New York Stock Exchange. So they are just listed on the NASDAQ. They've stayed there. Now, there are really, really tiny companies, dead companies, companies that are barely alive companies, that are on a subcategory of the NASDAQ called the pink sheet. Now, the pink sheets are these companies. You buy that just so you can throw your money away. I've known more than my share of people who just bought, you know, throw $100 into some pink sheet stocks. And they build up a pile of these pink sheet stocks over years and years. And then every now and then they go back through and check. Yep, they're all dead. But I do have to tell you, there was one SOB I did know. He had a weird thing. I mean, he was the strangest damn man. He was a very bad man. And if I could get him, I probably would kill him. Literally, if he were still alive, but he's dead. But he collected dead stock certificates, and he bought pink sheet stocks. He had this ginormous box of stock certificates. I mean, some of them were like from the 1800s, railroad stocks, stock certificates with gold filigree imprint along the borders, some of them. Some of them were just like handwritten stock certificates. And he came to me one day and he said, he showed it to me. I didn't know he had it. He said, Alan, Do you know any place where I could have someone figure out if there's any value whatsoever in any of this? And I actually did know a guy. He was an antiques dealer who specialized in securities antiques. Because some of those stock certificates had some value just because of the gold filigree and leafing around them. He had a railroad stock that was something like that. So I put them in contact with each other and didn't hear anything about it. This guy never told me about it, but I talked to the guy in New York City. I said, whatever happened with that Paul and his box? He said, oh, he didn't tell you? Everything in there. He had almost 80 certificates, different companies. Most of it was crap. But there were four that were really, really valuable. And I said, how valuable? Well, you know, they were companies that were bought by other companies and stock splits over the years and the decades and a century. How much? I don't know. I got them, I think, all close to $800,000. I took 20% of it. Son of a dog. Four of those certificates paid off out of all of them. Like I said, I really wish that man were still alive. Sometimes the problems he created still come back to haunt me. But anyway, okay, now. With stock like this, and I'll finish this up. I'm going to show you the formula for figuring out the price. Okay, first things first. Let's say that you bought the stock for $50. Now the dividend right now is let's make it easy. $1 per share, okay? $1 per share. So that would mean that the dividend yield on this stock is going to be $1 per share divided by $50 per share. So in other words, there's a 2% dividend yield. Think of that like that's your passbook savings account. You paid $50, you get a 2% per year return on it. Okay? That's one of the ways that you make money on common stock. The other way is through the capital gain yield on it, on the stock. So for example, if this stock in 1 year went up to, let's say, $55 per share, your capital gain would be 55 minus 50 for $5 per share, and then the gain yield on it would be $5 per share divided by the $50 per share that you paid for it to start. So you'd have a 10% capital gain yield. You put these two together and your total yield is going to be 12% on this stock purchase for that year. A side note here. Dividends are like income. You pay normal tax rates. You, madam, you look like a success-oriented human being. You'll probably end up in 35% tax bracket. Okay? So that would mean that your dividends that you get, and your income that you earn through your work, you'll obviously have loopholes and deductions you can play, but statute will say 35%. The playas, those massive houses where they are playing for capital gains, they pay no more than 15%. That's the capital gains tax rate. So if you are so wealthy that you can make all your money by just buying and selling stocks for gain, you will never pay more than 15% on all of the money you make. At worst, before you've used loopholes. If you are a normal working stiff who lives off your income and maybe a few dividend checks, you're going to pay out the butt compared to those Wall Street boys who manage to figure out ways, regardless of whether it's a Republican or a Democrat as a president. And all of the Congresses and Senates, they make sure that those Wall Street boys never pay the same thing that you will as working stiffs. Just keep that in mind. Now, the constant growth perpetuity formula. And again, I've shown you this before. If the perpetuity is not flat, like it is with preferred, but it grows at a constant rate, like it would normally with a stable, mature stock, your price will be the dividend in one period divided by the discount rate minus the growth rate of the dividends. So the whole thing is, and watch it when you're doing these problems in the quiz and the test and the homework. The dividend in one period is the dividend now times 1 plus the growth rate. So if they say the company just paid a dividend, you've got to grow it by one period. If they say the dividend next year will be, then they've already taken that into account. In the case of a stock like this, let's say that the dividend now is 25 cents per share. The growth rate of the dividends, let's say, is 5% per share. And this company's stock is being discounted, the cash flow from dividends, the market is discounting these at, let's say, 9% right now. So the way you would calculate the price of this stock would be to say 25 cents per share times 1 plus 5% to grow it to dividend 1, divided by the 0.09K minus the 0.05G. And doing that very quickly, just so you can see it in action. Come on. Seriously? There. Okay, so I would take 0.25 times 1.05 divided by, open parenthesis, 0.09 minus 0.05, close the parentheses. And I get a $6.56 stock. Okay, so now, the last part of this tonight, how do you invest? I don't tell you what stocks to buy, but I do strongly encourage you to buy a portfolio. The hard part is that you should be buying in round lots. In order to buy enough different stocks to make a decent diversification, and we'll talk a lot about this in the coming weeks, you would have to probably own no fewer than 30 different stocks. And you would want to make sure that they were all in a beta range that was consistent with your risk tolerance level based upon your internal personality and where you are in your life. However, all that having been said, there are a couple of rules for investing when you're buying stocks. You build your portfolio. Don't try to make your portfolio complete in one purchase. But, and again, don't ever rely on your employer or the government to make sure that you have nice, comfortable, happy times in your golden years. You're a fool if you do that. So here are some of the rules. First things first, when you're buying stocks, one good strategy, and there are other strategies too, but the one that is simple and it's always a clean strategy is what's called dollar average in. Dollar average in. And it's very simple. You spend the same amount of money every time you buy stock. You make it a policy that you're going to buy stock, a round lot or an ETF or a mutual fund, whatever it is, you spend the same amount of money. So in other words, you're going to buy stock, let's say, every 6 months. You're going to buy stock every 6 months. So you spend $1,000 every 6 months. Now, here's what that'll do for you. It sounds, well, what is, oh, who, you know, that's, when stock prices are low, that $1,000 is going to buy you a lot of stock. If stock prices have gone up a lot, that $1,000 isn't going to buy you much at all. So in other words, you are, by using the same absolute amount of money every time you buy, you are naturally biasing toward buying low. And that means that you're getting good prices. You're building your portfolio more when stock prices are low than when they're high. Do you understand the trick? It's as simple as you can get, but it really does work. Dollar averaging in, you just buy the same absolute dollar amount, whatever it is you're going to buy. But what that will do is guarantee that you are doing your biggest purchases of stock or mutual funds or ETFs or whatever it is during low stock, during lows. And as I said, don't ever dirty your diaper if there's a hurricane down. If the stock market goes down, don't panic. Leave your stock. If you got money, buy when the hurricane has wiped everything down to the ground. The people who, in the crisis of 2008, stocks were just collapsing everywhere. The people who sold out sold at ridiculously low prices. They couldn't get in and make their and do their sales until prices had already gone to hell. They still haven't recovered. The people who just left their stock in the market, right now, from where they were before the crash to where they are now, they're up close to 300%. The people who sold out during the crisis, they're still down. They're still in negative territory. That means don't ever panic during a panic. Yeah, that, and of course, if you were ever in the military, the one thing that the reason they treat you like dirt, they beat you, they discipline you, is so that you don't panic under fire. Because as soon as you panic, you've got what's called a rout. The enemy's just going to wipe you out, and then you got nothing. Now, here's another piece. Here's another part of it. If you are buying mutual funds or anything like that, if you're buying mutual funds or even anything like that, don't stick with just one fund. Buy, diversify. Diversify your funds. Okay? Four funds. Okay? So let's say after 1 year, now remember with mutual funds, you've got your portfolio diversification. And you can choose your beta for your risk level. So let's say that you buy four different funds and you can move them four times a year. So after a year, you see that your fund's performances have been this. The first thing you do is get rid of this fund and buy another fund that has had a better performance record for the last year. Now remember, history is not a guide to future performance. However, if you see a fund manager who's got mojo, let's say you saw a fund that had a 21% return in the family of funds that you can trade. You dump this one and put this one into your portfolio and you go forward. Now, 1 year later, what you do is you look at your funds again. Let's say you've got get rid of that one and just find one that has a higher performance record than what you've got in your portfolio on average as it is. Just keep, it's called skimming or creaming on your account. Just keep every year, just get rid of your, it's not going to cost you anything to do it. The same would be true with ETFs. You always get rid of the, have four. Four, you don't want to get too many because then it's hard to follow. You have four, always. You just punish the one that has the lowest performance. And make sure that you've got one that you can move into right away that still has a beta that's in your territory, but also has a performance for the last year that looks very good. And you just keep doing this. And I guarantee you, that if you stick to this and you discipline yourself to do it every year, don't do it too often, you're going to have an overall portfolio performance that is just top notch. And you'll have a decent chance at having a good retirement from that money. But again, there's a part of this that you got to understand. Your employer is going to take money out for a 401k or an ESOP or something like that. The government's going to take out money for Social Security for you. What I'm talking about is things, an investment that is not those. Those aren't under your control. But if you can put off, you know, I know you want to go out, you want to eat steak every night, you want to party hardy, you want to buy all the nice fun things in life, and don't put aside a few hundred dollars every month. Guarantee you, if you keep doing that, you can have enough so that you can have some really good things a little later in your life. In other words, foregone consumption now for a lot better future for you when they say, I'm sorry, we've got to terminate you because we've got a robot here that can do everything you can do and he's better looking than you are. That's all I have for you tonight. Go home.